trying to live right, trying to eat right. What? I got something to say, let me talk.
Let me talk.
You either feel me or you not.
Hello, I'm Edie Driscoll, your host for today's episode on crisis intervention. Even a couple of years ago, very few people thought about the trauma and risk inherent in calling 911 for a mental health crisis. Now we know that mental illness raises the chances of being killed by a police officer. The good news is that there are lots of models out there to improve services and reduce potential harm, and researchers are studying which are the safest. The future of policing will probably include a buffet of choices depending upon your circumstances, some offered by police and some not. To begin to sort this out, I'm speaking to a professor who studies the effectiveness of these options, a disability advocate who is charged with debating public policy in the state of Ohio, and the Columbus Police Commander who runs the Wellness Bureau where all these changes are being tested and installed. Between the three of them, I hope you will feel much more informed about what is happening and what decisions will be made in the near future that the community, that's you, need to weigh in on. Dr. Harold Pollack has had a long career as a respected public health researcher. In his current position as the co-director of the University of Chicago Urban Health Lab, he often sees the intersection of public health issues and public policy. He's currently involved in studies looking at best practices for crisis intervention. Let me welcome Dr. Pollack as we kick off this conversation about crisis intervention strategies. Thank you for being with us as Columbus is trying out different models this year. Can you catch us up on the research that is currently available and give us some basics of what all this is about?
There is an emerging research base that suggests that there's no polio vaccine that's always going to be perfect when first responders are dealing with issues like mental health crises. But there are best practices that are being adopted around the country that help. And crisis intervention teams and training in what's called CIT is quite valuable for local police, fire, other first responders. There's really three key principles that CIT really tries to impart: time, distance, and cover. When you encounter someone who is in a crisis, you're really not going to know why that person is in crisis necessarily if you're a first responder. And that's really not the issue. What you really want to do is give that person time to calm down, or time for other people to arrive to help you. It could be other first responders or social workers, or it could be someone who knows the person, or the person could just calm down and the situation resolves itself. Distance. So you want to stay away from someone and have them staying away from other people so that nobody's putting a hand on them. They're not putting a hand on other people. And cover, you know, if that person's presenting a safety threat, you know, the first responder needs to have a way to be protected from that. CIT training is very valuable. And when I talk to people, for example, who run homeless shelters and mental health facilities where they sometimes have to call 911, many of them say, hey, I really want to have a CIT trained officer come. They know those people have good training. And they also know that these are people who've specifically chosen to get that kind of training, which sends a reassuring signal to mental health professionals and family members when there is a crisis. So that's one thing. I think another thing that's really important is to provide backup to police and others so that people with actual training and resources can really deal with whatever the problem is that's causing someone to be in a crisis. If there's a homeless person who is cursing at passersby in the street and is presenting a potential public safety threat, the police can come and can help with that public safety threat, but they're not in a position to make sure that that person gets access to mental health care, that someone is following up with that person, that someone is talking with that person's loved ones to figure out what can be done to help. We need to have others in the mix you know, to back up the police, to do the things that the police really, you know, that's really not the police's job to do. And I think a lot of the real failures in our crisis response system is what I like to call the second response. It's not how did the officer behave when interacting with that individual. It's like what happened 2 days later, 2 hours later, 2 months later. And sadly enough, very often the answer is nothing, you know, until the next 911 call is made. So there's lots of things that are out there that are helpful.
Have you looked at models that take the police out of that mix, that they aren't the first responder?
Yeah, sometimes that can be helpful. I don't think one size fits all. You know, police, and sometimes you need to have police there, but they don't have to be, you know, directly there interacting with the person. Sometimes you might want to have a social worker or an EMT who's interacting with the person, and the police are in the background. Just in case there, you know, there is some kind of escalation, the police are there, but they don't have to be at the forefront. There's no question that there's a real role for other types of responders. And if we look at things like there's a widely cited one called the CAHOOTS model, where folks provide interventions who are not police officers and are often extremely successful. And that can be less triggering for a lot of the people that are in crisis when you don't have someone who's sort of a burly person in a uniform, maybe even carrying a weapon, you know, in your face. Sometimes it's easier for people to calm down when it's a different person presenting. So no question that we'd like to have others in the mix for many of these calls.
Is there any research, to your knowledge, about peer support models? Is that happening in other areas?
I would say that there's a lot of activity. There's no airtight research that's been done, but there's a lot of good activity. You know, here in Chicago, I'm hoping that we can do more of that. I would say that also it matters a ton how the interventions are actually implemented. You know, when you say we should have peers responding, boy, there's an awful lot under the hood in that. That has to be done right. You know, who are the peers? How are they trained? What kinds of calls are they responding to? And how are they supported in the work that they do? I hypothesize that what we will find in the research is that, wow, the quality of the interventions makes a huge difference. The same as the quality of the police training makes a huge difference. If you say, should police respond to certain calls? Which police officers? How are they trained? What do they do? And so I'm a big believer in non-police response, including peer response. I think we have to learn how to do that with excellence. And I'm sure that in Columbus, the folks who really know on the ground how to do this well, you want to make sure we're talking to those people and understanding, what are the pain points? What are the opportunities? How do we train peers so they can do this job well? And how do we support them? Because it's a very difficult role. People bear witness to a lot of difficult stuff. So you have to support people in those peer roles if that's going to be sustainable for folks.
That makes perfect sense. And you obviously spend a lot of time thinking about this. What else do we need to know? What is community not even thinking to ask yet?
Well, I think that we have to confront a couple of things. One is we have to confront the real diversity of circumstances that lead people to be in crisis. I think we often have a stereotypical image in our head of what a mental health crisis is that is true some of the time for these calls, but not others. So, you know, for example, my wife and I care for her brother. He's a 260-pound man who lives with an intellectual disability called Fragile X syndrome. And a lot of the caregivers for sons with Fragile X syndrome report that sometimes their sons get aggressive. And, you know, sometimes people will call 911. These are not people necessarily with a psychiatric disorder. They're not, having an open conversation with Jesus standing out in the middle of the highway. They have a different set of challenges. We also have to deal with addiction stigma. One of the things that many cities find is police officers and other first responders are often extremely compassionate and effective when someone is stereotypically psychotic and it matches the image that people have in their head of what a mental health crisis is. If there's substance use involved, very often you get a less compassionate response because addiction stigma is just a really deep thing within our society and among our first responders. Second thing I would say is we have to give the mundane realities of policing and emergency medical services their due. One of the things we find in Chicago is that if I'm in a mental health crisis, and it's a pretty low crime community and it's a Tuesday and it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I have a much better chance of having the first response really bringing its A game to that, because they have the time to do it. You know, if it takes three or four police officers 45 minutes to calm somebody down and get him to a mental health facility, they have the time. There's just not a lot going on in that moment for them. When I was on something called the Police Accountability Task Force in Chicago, I heard a story where there was a gentleman who was in a mental health crisis in his home, and it was on a really busy Saturday night in a high crime district. And there's a policewoman who was the CIT officer. A lot of the best CIT officers are women, and she was one of them. And she was really making progress with this gentleman. She was talking to him and calming him down and trying to get him to come with her, in the police car. But while she was talking to him, her cell phone was going nuts and her supervisor's cell phone was going nuts. There's a shooting here. There's a crime here. We need you. And at some point, her supervisor runs past her, tackles the guy, doesn't harm him, but manhandles him and cuffs him, puts him in the car, and basically says, "Hey, I just had to wrap this up. I didn't have 45 minutes right now to do what I would have loved to do if I had more time." And it is very labor intensive to be compassionate. One of the things that we have to do is we have to talk to our first responders and our police officers, first of all, to deal with their reality and how difficult it is to navigate a lot of these calls, but also to say, what do you need just in a very mundane way so that you can respond to these calls effectively, given the time that you need and the resources that you need to do this well. I think police officers and emergency medical service folks, they want to do a good job in crisis response. They really do. And they need help to do that. And they need support to do that. And they also need to get a high five when they resolve a crisis like this, with no one getting hurt. If you have a culture, that treats this as an annoyance, oh gosh, another mental health 911 call, and you're never going to get a high five for that. That does not set a great dynamic for effective response. A lot of police departments, you get a lot more positive praise because you physically subdued a scary criminal than you do because you got someone mental health services and you never had to put a hand on that person because you were able to compassionately talk to that person and help them through a crisis. So we have to, those kinds of issues are important too.
Sure. That gives us so much to think about. Thank you so much for your time today. And I do hope we'll talk again soon. It sounds like you're on the forefront of understanding where the industry's going, and we want to keep up with that.
Thanks so much. I appreciate the chance to talk, and pardon my my rambling responses on various things.
No problem. Take care. Kevin Truitt is the Legal Advocacy Director at Disability Rights Ohio, which is a federally mandated and funded protection and advocacy group appointed by the governor to work for people with disabilities. In this role, Kevin is notifying local and state government officials on the policies that will best protect folks with mental and other disabilities who might be harmed by interaction with police. Welcome, Kevin. Thank you so much for being with me today. I know this is a really important topic in the field of policing, and I'm really happy that you're here to help us unpack some of it. I would like to start at the very, very beginning, just by having you help us understand what is a crisis and how does a person or family decide when they need additional help to get through it?
Yes. So crisis can mean a lot of different things, and it doesn't necessarily mean someone has a disability, but often someone may have a mental illness or a developmental disability, some other type of diagnosis, and they're really struggling in the moment, and whether that's panicking or feeling suicidal, or it's an emergency, urgent situation, and they definitely need help, right?
Yeah.
And in Columbus and across the country, the only option for a lot of people is to call 911, to call law enforcement. And that often ends in tragedies, harmful outcomes.
So let's go back for a second. Tell me a little bit more about mental health, mental illness, and you mentioned suicide, possibly panic attacks. Are there larger diagnosis groups maybe, or situations that people find themselves in that are more likely to result occasionally in a crisis of this nature?
That's a good question. I don't know that I can speak to that just because I'm not a clinician or a mental health professional. Our focus is more on how systems should work in our society to meet people's needs.
Okay.
And so there are such massive investments in law enforcement in America, including in Columbus, where a third of the entire city budget is devoted to the police, where people's needs just aren't being met, or are really the only option for a lot of situations is to call the police. And like I said, that often results in tragedies and other harmful outcomes. So pushing legislators, policymakers to fund systems that actually work for people and do not harm them, and taking a compassionate, trauma-informed, anti-oppressive, anti-racist approach to problems in our society, that's what we're pushing for.
What happens currently when a family in this sort of crisis asks the Columbus Division of Police for assistance?
Well, that's a good question. So often people will call 911 and say either they or their family member is in crisis and they need help. Often the city will send police officers. Sometimes that includes a co-responder team, which is law enforcement and a social worker, to respond to this crisis. But something that we've recognized in doing this work over the past year or two is when law enforcement responds to these crisis situations, it inherently escalates the situation. A person is in crisis, and then an officer arrives to the scene, and that officer has the authority to arrest, incarcerate, maybe take them to a psychiatric hospital, which can be just as harmful as going to jail. So having that authority, having on a police officer's uniform, having a badge, having handcuffs, a taser, a gun, all of that can be very, very threatening to someone in crisis. And even if they're trained to try to understand mental illness or crisis situations better than an officer without that training, like, it's still an inherent escalation of the situation. That's what we've heard from people with lived experience, people with mental illness who have been through crisis situations in the past, and law enforcement has shown up to that crisis situation, and that is the last thing they need, is to feel threatened and to feel like this is going to get worse.
So in Columbus, we have something folks may have heard of called CIT officers. How is their training different, or how is their response different than what you've described?
Well, I'm not an expert on CIT training, but that is not the model that we've been pushing for. It's the model, my limited understanding of it is, it's a model that a training model for police officers that help them understand mental health and or mental illness and crisis situations and respond better to those situations. We're pushing for law enforcement to be completely taken out of the equation. So if a person is in crisis or their family member is in crisis, what's the best way to respond to that? And we've been pushing for models that don't involve police officers showing up on the scene, even if they're trained, even if they have a social worker with them. It often still leads to harmful outcomes, leads to this escalation, which we want to avoid, right? And so we're pushing for those individuals who are professionally trained. They're not police officers. They're not wearing a police uniform or have a badge or a gun or taser, handcuffs, all of those things which escalate these situations. And so how can we help the person calm down, or depending on what's happening, depending on what the crisis looks like, how can we help that person move out of that crisis and begin to recover and heal from whatever was going on? That's a reinvestment from these massive amounts of money, which city budgets, including Columbus, invest in police, and investing those resources into alternatives like mental health systems and crisis response systems that don't involve law enforcement.
Did you see the press conference last week with the announcement of the new pilot program?
Yes, I was excited to see that. So when the city first announced their new budget a month or two ago, was pretty disappointed that they were decided to invest more in this co-responder model, which, as I said, involves both police officers and social workers. But this pilot program that was announced last Friday is the model that we're pushing for, which, again, is taking police officers, taking law enforcement out of the equation completely. And so it's a pilot program. It's very, there's not a lot of details that we've seen yet from the city, but a pilot program to invest in these alternative models, social workers responding to mental health crises in the community. Even if we take police officers out of the equation, there are still harmful outcomes that can occur. So if a police officer arrives to a crisis, like they can arrest, they can take a person to jail, they can take them to a psychiatric hospital. These are all harmful outcomes. A social worker, even just a social worker alone responding to a crisis, can still cause harmful outcomes. So psychiatric hospitalization sometimes is necessary, at least in our current system, but is often overused and can be just as harmful as taking someone to jail for a few days, right? Like you get locked in a hospital and separated from your home and your family and your pets and your job, and you may end up there longer than a few days, and it could be weeks, it could be months, and that could be very, very harmful. So I want to make sure that even as the city hopefully invests in this alternative model, that we have a system that's not producing these harmful outcomes too.
It seems that their first piece that they're looking at exploring in the model or the test is the actual call, that if a family calls in, there's a question, of course, in a system analysis of, does the family need to know a different number to call? Does the family need to analyze their situation before they call? Or when they call the 911, can the family divert the call to a social worker, or will the person that receives the 911 call then divert the call? You know, those are all different steps in a process that I think folks haven't really figured out which is the best way to do it. Do you have an opinion on that?
That's a good question. And I think a huge part of this moving forward is community education. So if, like I said earlier, for so many situations in our society, the only option for a lot of people is to call the police or just not call the police and try to address the situation on their own, which there's been a movement in Columbus and across the country. Don't call the police on Black people, right? Because that could get people killed. And that's very sensible, right? But we should all also have systems in place that can meet people's needs that doesn't include calling the police. It's my understanding here in Columbus, the dispatch teams for emergency calls is going to be not within the division of police, but in the division of public safety. So there'll be a system where someone calls 911, and potentially if it's a mental health crisis, then it gets funneled to this alternative model, right?
Right.
So the dispatchers are making that decision. Does this go to the police or does this go to this alternative crisis response model that doesn't involve the police? Another idea would be to have like a completely different number that doesn't involve that dispatcher making decisions. Should this go to the police or should this not go to the police? And so I don't know if the city is contemplating something like that, but that seems worth considering. And then there would be, like I mentioned a little bit ago, a huge part of that would be community education, right? Like making sure people in our community know if you or your family member or neighbor is experiencing some type of crisis, you can call this number. You don't have to call 911.
Right. It's an interesting leap to think that a family could call for help and say, absolutely, in no circumstance do I want a police officer to respond, and know that that would happen. You know, there just seems to be too many people, even social workers are bound by their licensure to report, right, to report certain things. So I think we're a long way away from people knowing that a police officer would not show up if that were their choice. We've used a lot in the last few years the term first responder. And mm-hmm. I think in mental health, there is a concern that even if we fix the first responder process that we've been talking about, we still have a second responder level that is in a lot of disrepair, I think we might say. The question is, what do we do? So we get the social workers in place and they're responding, and then how do we know they won't be out again next week? You know, what other services will we need to put into place to finish this cycle, this process?
Yeah, that's a really important point. So that's something else we've been pushing, not only the city, but the state of Ohio to invest in mental health systems, right? Not just crisis mental health services, but the services that people need to live happy, fulfilling lives in our communities, right? And so addressing the root causes of these crises and is very important and has to be a part of this. So we don't want to just be responding to crises in a way that doesn't involve law enforcement. That's something we obviously support and have been pushing for, but also we want to reduce the number of these crises that even happen in the first place, right? And so, for example, we wrote a letter to Columbus City Council a few months ago and we were pushing for this alternative model, non-policing model. And we brought up the issue of homelessness. Like police officers should not be responding to someone who is homeless, living on the streets, right? And mm-hmm. maybe is in crisis. That's not an appropriate response to have police officers there. But also, there shouldn't be homelessness in Columbus. That shouldn't be a reality in Columbus. So investing in not only these alternative models, but investing in housing, investing in mental health systems, substance abuse treatment, jobs with living wages, all those other things that are the root causes of so many problems that we see in our society. So I think that's a really important point to make too.
Yeah, I think prevention always is cheaper than treatment. Yeah. And I know that a lot of these concerns end up in an emergency room, which is one of the most expensive ways to do anything. So there seems like there would be money there to redirect to other prevention programs and community support initiatives. But Kevin, you've been in this work for a while, and you're obviously very passionate about it. Have you been able to have these conversations about how these crisis calls are handled in the past, or is this a new world?
It's pretty new for me and my organization. And so it's really been since last summer that these conversations about reinvesting in community service systems and instead of investing so much money in our police departments, it's really been since last summer, the Black Lives Matter movement, which just exploded last summer, pushed this conversation forward. And I'm so grateful for that movement and for all those that were out in the streets and protesting police brutality and racial injustice. So proud of that. And I firmly believe that these conversations would not be happening today without that movement. So I'm very grateful for that movement. And we did a report late last year on police brutality and racial injustices and the ways that those issues intersect with disability issues. Our report went through data and numbers on how people of color and people of color who have disabilities disproportionately are killed by police or other harmful outcomes, arrests, incarceration, so forth. And we, as we were drafting the report, we had to keep updating it because we were naming specific people in our report, like Freddie Gray, Sandra Bland, Eric Gardner. The list is so long, and we had to keep updating it as we were drafting it. So Daniel Prude in Rochester, New York, for example, mm-hmm. was experiencing a mental health crisis and was killed by police. And I remember having to update our report with his name. And it was just so sad and tragic because it just continues to happen over and over in this country.
This has been really, really, really interesting. What have we missed? What else can you share with us that we need to know to be good, advocates for these new solutions?
So I want to mention also that it is so important to listen to the voices and perspectives of people with lived experience. And so people who have been through traumatic, harmful interactions with law enforcement in the past, which is disproportionately people of color and people who have mental disabilities, psychiatric disabilities, it's so important to listen to them, what they would have needed in that moment and what they need to be a part of our communities and be safe in our communities. And so I've learned so much just from talking to people about their experiences. That's really informed our advocacy and how we're pushing the city's leaders to respond to the needs in our community, not with punitive measures like law enforcement, but with compassion and empathy and solidarity with our community members, right? And so one thing that I haven't mentioned is the importance of peer support specialists. So that's basically people with lived experience with mental illness who know what it's like to be in crisis, who know what it's like not to have any other options but to call the police. A peer support specialist helping people through crisis in the moment and can be very effective. And there's been a lot of studies on the effectiveness of peer support specialists.
Yeah, I think that's even more important because of the stigma that continues to surround folks with mental illness, that they're not really sure who to trust to to speak to. And as I was listening to you say, we need to listen to them, I'm thinking, but they've been taught not to speak. They've been taught that, that when they do speak, they only get more problems or oppression or fewer jobs or fewer places to live or whatever their needs are in that moment. So I think the peer support model sounds wonderful. Are there groups in town that are developing those models or training those peer support folks?
Those do exist in Ohio and across the country. Those are conversations that we're going to be having over the next few months with different allies and stakeholders to bring them into this conversation if they're not already, to make sure they're part of the solution here. I think that's very important.
Well, I think that is a reason to talk to you again. I think we want to hear in a few months how that work is going. And I really appreciate your time today. And I think you've gotten us started with a lot of things to think about. Thank you so much.
Hey.
Cool.
Hey.
Commander Dave Hughes is the Wellness Bureau Commander for the Columbus Division of Police. He oversees both officer wellness and the external wellness and outreach programs for the community, including crisis intervention. Welcome, Commander Hughes. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's so nice to have you.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this stuff.
You are in a position to see this from the inside out, and CPD is doing some new things with these crisis response models. And recently we heard about something they call the Alternative Response Pilot Program. And my understanding is that they are studying different approaches to how they will respond when calls come in. Can you tell us more about this or what they hope to learn from this pilot?
Yeah, absolutely. The Columbus Fire Department and the Columbus Police Department have put together it's a 6-week pilot program that's currently being housed at our Radio Room Center on Fairwood. And what this is there's a social worker that was hired by Columbus Public Health that has been embedded in what they call the pod. And in this room, there's a fire dispatcher, there's an EMS supervisor that supervises all EMS type calls. The social worker, you have a police commander, another police commander who's working on this pilot program. And they are basically diverting calls that are coming in the 911. And they're saying, do we really need to send a firefighter? Do we really need to send a police officer out to this call? Are there other things we can do from a radio room perspective that would lessen our calls for service and get the right services that they need? So I had a chance to visit the pod. It just started last week. And had a chance to tour it and kind of watch it in action. A call had come in, and they were trying to get this. It was a 10-year-old that needed some help. And at the end of the day, we wound up, they talked to her for about an hour trying to get this person some help. And they wound up sending a medic out, didn't send a police officer out, which normally a police officer probably would have automatically been sent out to help this young person.
Interesting.
So they're really trying to find ways to triage the calls. Because as you know, 911 has become like the fail-safe for everything. Everything people are calling 911 for, my kid's not taking his medication or my husband's not bathing. So we're getting all these calls. Do we really need to send police and fire out to these type of calls? So that pilot program is due to continue on, and we're looking forward to seeing those results and what's being diverted. Some of the things that are being diverted, the Central Ohio area of agency, OAAA, Columbus Fire has a SPARK program, which is a group of firefighters that will we don't need to call a paramedic out. Maybe we can do a later follow-up with the SPARK team to, help out with getting someone out of the bed or some more services or some more medical care that they really don't need right now in the moment. So we're waiting to see the results of this pilot program, and we should see it probably mid-July.
So this pilot is one person on one shift. Is that right? Or are they doing it 24/7?
Right now they're doing it just one person. It's in the evening hours. I think it's in the second shift afternoon. That's when our highest call volume for mental crisis come in. So So they're right now doing it with one social worker just for a short amount of time. And then they're going to see if, you know, we want to expand this. Do we want to expand it 24 hours? But they want to get a kind of a good sample of what to expect and what, where we can divert. The problem is there's not a whole lot of there's not a whole lot of people she could send that aren't non-police.
I was wondering about that.
So we're trying So, you know, we're trying to see if, you know, can we divert, make referrals to Nationwide Children's and some of these other, in that care and some other type of appointments with other mental health facilities that, but right now, at the end of the day, like I think one call they had, they spent a pretty good hour and a half talking to this person and they had to send someone out anyways, but they tried. They really tried to get to the nitty gritty without having to send services out.
Earlier this year, City Council, when they approved the budget, announced that there was a new program with some coordinating with Columbus Public Health social workers. What do we know about that program?
So this is part of that. The City Council authorized to hire up to 20 social workers to help with crisis response and, you know, maybe non-crisis response. So as you know, people, the social worker is the big term right now. And I think sometimes people think social workers grow on trees. I wish we had a lot more of them. But I think we're finding is the hiring the right person and to get social workers to work for this pilot is going to be a little challenging. So because it's not going to be a Monday through Friday, weekends off, day shift type of job. So we're going to need to have people work in the evenings and on weekends. And traditionally, social workers, from my understanding, I've never been one, but talking to them, that's not the model. So this is something that's going to be a little challenging in the future to hire the right ones that will be willing to work those hours. So this is part of that, the hiring of 20 additional social workers falling under public health. And really, Columbus Public Health is a great partner, and they're working this from the ground up and starting from scratch and trying to really understand what other cities that are successful are doing. And we've been trying to, you know, point them like in Denver and Colorado Springs. There's a lot of police departments and public health departments that are doing Eugene, Oregon, doing type of these co-responder or just, you know, non-police response. And they're really trying to take it all in and get a good product for our residents.
So these new programs differ from the traditional response, which would be that immediately an officer would go out and then the officer would say, oh, this is now, there's a need here for additional help from social workers or other personnel. So what this response does is it kind of moves it back to the dispatch level where that diversion happens. Would that be a nice way to summarize it, that we're not allowing?
And it's a big bite because that's a huge animal to tackle. Like you want to make sure we're getting, you don't want to not send somebody and something bad could happen because you don't send somebody. So it's really, they got to find the happy sweet spot on, you know, how can you triage this call and not just automatically just send somebody out or let them wait in the queue. So it's a lot of heavy lifting. And I think that's probably the right way to get your communication policies and your triage down. And then you can, okay, what is the right response? Who is the right people we should send in the moment to help this resident?
Is there a model in play or that you're aware of where the community could make that choice themselves? You know, if I called and said, you know, we're having a problem in our household and I do not want a police officer here, is that an option?
It's interesting you asked that because about a week ago I was asked, there's a website, Do Not Call the Police, I think .com, and it listed a lot of resources on there to, if you did want to call the police, you could call, you know, some of these numbers. But the problem is I sent it over to my friends at Adam H and they were like, oh, that's not accurate. Some of that information wasn't accurate. These aren't 24-hour service providers. They don't provide that service. And so they were a little concerned that, you know, people might not get the right, you know, response from the numbers of the people they fund from Adam H with some of these mental crisis help centers. So I know, and I've also heard, I think it's like, you know, like not, there's the 911, but I've heard there's like a 988 number that is being used in other parts of the country where it's not a police type response. It's a mental health crisis type. You can call this number if you don't want to call the police to help with mental crisis. I would say from my interactions with public health and with fire that the world's the oyster right now. We've got an open table and we're willing to look at all options.
Sure.
And not be, you know, narrow-minded on what we're going to do. We want to do the right thing.
What is the next step in terms of moving forward with any or all of these options, and how can the community help the police department figure this out?
Yeah, so, you know, obviously we still have our mental crisis response teams on the police side, where we have a NetClear clinician that is riding with a CI trained officer. We have, five teams that really try to handle all these acute 911, you know, suicidal ideation type calls. And unfortunately, in 2020, we had over 22,000 of these calls that came into the division. And I'm just looking at the numbers here. Our numbers of those 22,000, we responded to 4,449 of those. And I'm happy to say I looked at all this transport. We did over 1,200 transports to either mental health facilities. And of those 1,253, only four of them were taken to Franklin County Jail. So we really are getting, our MCR teams are getting people in crisis to the right locations to get the help they need. So I just wish I had 20 of them. You know, I wish I had more, because that number is like, you know, 7 or 8% of all the calls that came in that my teams could get to. There's a lot of other calls that my MCR folks couldn't get to that maybe a CIT trained officer was able to. And if they weren't able to, you know, a non-CIT officer would have been sent to. But our numbers we're seeing in our ready room for mental crisis have gone consistently up over the years. And I think there's definitely a big need for more co-responder model. But I also think there's a big need for a non-police response. Some of our MCR folks have to do case management. And that entails, you know, maybe going to remind a person to take their medicine or remind a person to, you know, they got a doctor's appointment 2 days. And I really don't think we should be having police officers do a lot of case management, because I worry about the stigma of that resident who, you know, the neighbors see a police car that's, oh, it's going to Bob's house again. I think there definitely is a need and a push that we could have a non-police response type of team that could go out and handle those. Hey, remind this guy that there's the food pantries this week. And, you know, not necessarily a police officer. So how the community can help with that, I just think, you know, we're open to all these ideas and suggestions. I think our stats on MCR are proving that it's working. And this co-responder model is getting the right people to the right place. I think of last year, I think we only had four or five uses of forces, and they were low numbers. They were like a grabbing a person by the arm. It wasn't like a baton strike or a macing. I mean, we really tried to de-escalate these calls for service, and our numbers are showing that this is effective. And I think this is the future. Well, there's times where our officers in MCR have been spent, you know, an hour or two talking to somebody, really trying to get to the root of the issue. And a normal patrol officer just doesn't have the time to do that.
Tell us what MCR means.
I'm sorry, it's the MCR's Mental Crisis Response Team, MCR.
And then CIT is?
Crisis Intervention Training, the Crisis Intervention Team. It is a 40-hour block of training that it's funded by Adam H. And they use our academy, and we will train any law enforcement officer in Franklin County for this class, this 40-hour class we do. We do about five or six of them a year.
And how many officers within CPD have been trained in CIT?
So to date, we mandate all academy classes. So all new hires, after they go through their field training and their academy training, we bring them back. It's mandated they go through this. So our numbers right now are about 525 of our officers have been trained in CIT. That's just Columbus.
And so the folks on the MCR teams, have they had additional training to the CIT, or is that where they get their training as well?
Yeah, so the MCRT, they're all CIT officers that have been certified, but most of the MCR they're getting it on the job learning, and they're with their licensed clinician. So they're partners, and they work off each other, they feed off each other, and they tag team these calls.
My last guest, Kevin Truitt from Disability Rights Ohio, was advocating against a co-responder model because some people who are in a mental health crisis find the presence of an officer with a uniform and a gun very triggering. Can you speak to that and how you're addressing that within CPD?
So I probably should clarify, our mental crisis response team members, they wear a totally different uniform. They're not the traditional white shirt and gun belt. They wear a like a BDU khaki colored pants. They wear a polo shirt, and they do wear obviously bulletproof vests, but their uniform is distinctly different than what a regular patrol officer in a car would be. We've heard the same. We've had the concerns that some folks don't think there should be a co-responder model. I disagree. Our numbers are going up. My concern, and it's always a safety concern for the social worker, is we've had a social worker in 2001 who was brutally stabbed on a home visit. Her name was Nancy Fitzgibbons. And I remember vividly as a new officer that she had gone to a house on a well check, and a father had stabbed her multiple times. And so I have a concern with a social worker going in to a neighborhood, sometimes without an officer. That is a big concern of me, that you know, whatever we do with this right response model or this co-responder model, what we're going to do, I think safety needs to be paramount. And while I agree there's plenty of situations where I don't think an officer needs to be at a house, I also need to balance that with there could be a house that a social worker could be walking into that they don't know the history of how many times we've been out there and the weapons that might be at this house and the instability. So I really struggle from that because I don't want to see a social worker ever get hurt trying to do the right thing to help out somebody in crisis. Again, to answer your question, yeah, I understand some people don't think the co-responder model works. I would argue our stats show they have. It's showing less use of force, less people going to jail, more people getting the help, and it's safer. It's safer for everyone involved. But there, you know, that's something that we, you know.
Yeah, it sounds like this takes us back to the dispatch path that you're running right now. Because we started by saying it's really hard to decide sometimes which team to send out, like how to know, is this a situation that might be safe for a social mm-hmm. worker by themselves? But I think collecting that data and knowing how those calls are being screened and what information the dispatcher has that maybe a social worker wouldn't have if they were just getting the calls directly, that may add that level of safety. So I'm sure the data that you're collecting and the pilot, which I'm sure won't be the last thing that you study, will help lead us towards safety for everyone. I want to thank you so much. This was an awful lot of good information that I'm sure the community is going to be able to use to give you feedback. As you've said, you need some help. You need everybody involved in this. So thank you so much for coming, and we'll talk again soon.
Oh, you're very welcome. And like I said, we were really excited to, we just asked the community to be patient with us. We're not going to fix this overnight. And we're probably going to make some mistakes here and there. But I think at the end of the day, all the right intentions are in place from all the right players. And it's getting that multidisciplinary team approach, including the community, to tell us what do you want? What do you want in your police and fire departments? And what do you want your response to be if you had a loved one that's experiencing a mental health crisis? What would you like to see? So we're excited about it. I think this is the future of law enforcement. And I'm just glad we're part of being on the front lines of it.
Thank you so much. Take care. Thanks for listening to this episode. Make sure to check out our other in-depth reporting on policing in Columbus at matternews.org. If you have any questions or suggestions for future episodes, please email hello@matternews.org. Why you crossing the line? I'm just raising
raising my voice. Why you keeping me down?